Today's guest is Dr. Thomas Seyfried. He published groundbreaking research, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease, the Origin, Management, and Prevention of Cancer. We know that you are going to find so many valuable insights in today's interview. His concept has implications for the development of new non-toxic cancer therapies, including the ketogenic diet. Experts in the cancer research field are praising his research, and we are so honored to have him as a guest today. Let's go!
The most energetic, fit, and stress-resilient people on the planet practice daily habits to keep their hormones balanced, their gut healthy, and their muscles and mind strong. Welcome to That Fitness Couple. We're Mike and Corey Beth Lepowski, founders of Pure Physique.
This podcast is designed to provide you with everything we've discovered and continue to discover about nutrition, training, and lifestyle. Today, we all live hectic lives.
So we've made it our mission to make your fitness time efficient and to build you up. Hope you share and enjoy. Let's dive into today's episode. Let's go.
You want to kick things off or you want me to?
I think I will.
Go for it.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we are just so excited that you are here. And as always, we always start our episode with a true or false set of questions. So the first one, number one, cancer is a genetic disease.
Well, you know, that seems to be the conventional wisdom based on the National Cancer Institute's website and based on the majority of books on cancer. But the new evidence says that the genetic mutations are an effect rather than the cause. So the cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease, and the mutations are downstream effects rather than causes.
Wow. I can't wait to get into this conversation.
All right. And number two would be commonly held beliefs and theories about cancer are based in faulty science.
No, I wouldn't say that it's based on faulty science. I think that there are alternative interpretations of the science rather than the science being faulty. Not to say that there is not faulty science. In fact, that's one of the problems that we have with the Broken Science Initiative is that many of the papers written in some of the top scientific journals on cancer have been difficult to reproduce and therefore are questioned by whether the science was faulty or whether it wasn't done completely enough or one of these kinds of things. It's never so, you know, black and white on these kinds of things.
Well, what about this one? You can get cancer from damaged mitochondria.
Mostly correct, but you have to say it's chronic. It can only occur. That's only part one. Part two is a compensatory fermentation. So if you damage mitochondria too acutely, the cell will die, and you'll never get cancer from a dead cell. So it usually involves prolonged, protracted disruption of energy through oxidative phosphorylation, coupled with a compensatory energy that does not use oxygen, which is referred to as fermentation. So it's a two-part process that gives you the dysregulated cell growth.
Number four, true or false, you can only treat cancer by improving the health of the mitochondria.
You can prevent cancer by keeping your mitochondria healthy. But once your mitochondria become corrupted, it's kind of an irreversible problem. So you have to then target the fuels that are leading to the abnormal fermentation to manage the cancer. So it's a little bit, again, more involved.
Well, next is that the rise of cancer can be traced back to the same cause as the rise in obesity.
There is considerable overlap in that regard. We now know that obesity is replacing smoking as a number one risk factor for cancer. You know, it's diet and lifestyle, predominantly diet and lifestyle. And I think that contributes to both obesity, type 2 diabetes, many chronic diseases, as well as cancer.
Right. Number six would be true or false. All disease is the result of metabolic dysfunction.
Well, chronic disease, largely for sure. But you can have other kinds of disorders that are what we call inborn errors of metabolism. These are much less like cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease. Alzheimer's is also linked significantly to diet and lifestyle. But no, not all diseases are that. I mean, you have to separate them. Chronic diseases versus inborn errors of metabolism and things like this.
My last question is, cancer cells
can be starved off and killed.
Yeah, if you're taking away the only two fuels that drive the dysregulated growth, that's our plan. That's the strategy for the new standard of care for managing cancer, is depriving them of the fuels that drive the fermentation metabolism, which all cancer cells express.
I can't wait to get into that one. Yep. Well, you've conducted extensive research, Dr. Seyfried, showing that cancer can really be best defined as a mitochondrial metabolic disease rather than a genetic disease. Can you walk our listeners through that?
Yeah, well, this starts with the work of Otto Warburg from the 1920s and 30s, the 20th century, a dominant figure. He clearly showed what the origin of cancer happened to be. It was chronic damage to oxidative phosphorylation, the way cells get energy, the way you guys are breathing, your exercise programs, all of this kind of stuff keeps most of our cells healthy and energetic. Warburg showed that these cancer cells are not using oxygen for energy. They're obtaining from fermentation metabolism. There had been a tremendous amount of controversy in what Warburg says. And I have to be honest with you, most of the people today that are molecular biologists, they seem to not understand this, that it's very hard to pin down. You'd think all these smart, educated people at top medical schools would know that. And yet they continue to criticize Warburg based on a tremendous lack of knowledge. And I'll give you some more examples of this. Yeah, cancer originates with chronic damage to oxidative phosphorylation. And as Warburg said, step two is a compensatory fermentation. What Warburg did not know was that there is a second fuel, a fermentable fuel, the amino acid glutamine, which is the most abundant amino acid in our body. And it's the glucose, the sugar fermentation, and it's the glutamine fermentation that drive the dysregulated growth of the tumor cell, producing what we call reactive oxygen species, which are damaging to biological tissues, and that leads to the mutations in the nucleus. But you will see in all, and even on the National Cancer Institute website, it says cancer is a genetic disease, speaking to the fundamental lack of their knowledge in recognizing this. And it's an ideology. This is what keeps us from advancing the field and reducing deaths. And as you know, there are 1,700 people a day in our country dying from cancer, which is about 70 an hour throughout the country. And it's getting worse, and it will continue to get worse or progress if the NIH, National Cancer Institute, continues to push this misinformation or lack of understanding that it's a genetic disease. And this is, it's related to power more than it is to science. The power of the systems, the system of standard of care, which is involved, it involves the National Institutes of Health, it involves the academic research industry and the pharmaceutical industry, all of which are pushing this whole idea that cancer is a genetic disease and targeting mutations and doing all this kind of stuff, because it's essentially based on an incorrect theory. If the theory under which you're treating the disease is not correct, the outcome will never be optimal for the majority of people suffering from the disease. So when you're saying that cancer is a genetic disease, the therapies that you're developing are based on that. And if that's based on a theory, and if the theory is incorrect, like I've mentioned, the people are going to continue to suffer and die. Now, we know that treating cancer patients with toxic chemicals and radiation and all these kinds of things, surgical mutilations, we were hoping, the field was hoping, that we wouldn't need to do this with the promise of the genomic programs, the genomic atlases, and all these multi-billion-dollar research programs. We were hoping that we could get rid of poisonous chemicals, radiation, and this other stuff. And the reason we're still doing that is because the hope, the promise of the genome, cancer is a genetic disease, never came. The promise is not there. And that's because the underlying theory upon which we've spent these hundreds of billions of dollars is not correct.
Where did this theory actually originate?
Well, the theory originated from Theodore Bovary in 1914. And actually, if you look, he's recognized as the father of the genetic theory of cancer. He was a very distinguished German scientist. He actually discovered that that genes were located on chromosomes. Before that, nobody knew where they were located. But in actual fact, he studied sea urchins and he knew nothing about cancer. And he just purely speculated that cancer might be due to some type of chromosomal abnormalities. But his friends that worked in the oncology industry thought he was nuts. And he actually never excluded the cytoplasm as a possible. And he was very apologetic. He said, Bovary said, I don't really know anything about cancer. And most of what I'm saying in this essay is probably wrong. I mean, he was upfront about it. It's just so happens that when the structure of DNA was discovered in the 1950s by Watson and Crick and others, not just them alone, the field of biology ran off chasing gene changes and all this kind of stuff because it was sexy and it was quantitative. And then you found mutations in cancer cells. And so I would say it really started big in the 1960s when people started to really think cancer was a genetic disease, because you did find mutations for sure. And then there were all kinds of studies showing that you can manipulate genes and get dysregulated cell growth, but the manipulations they never realized were also damaging oxidative mitochondria. They never realized that what they were getting was due to a different interpretation than what they thought. So, and then of course, the Nobel committees have awarded a number of Nobel prizes to scientists pushing this idea that cancer is a genetic disease. So the field more or less developed an ideology, which is a dogmatic view, silent assumption that this must be the case. So when Warburg's work was recognized again by myself and others, then you had to twist the facts around to maintain the ideology, but also acknowledge there might be a metabolic problem. So how you twist it around, you say that the metabolic problem in cancer cells, their fermentation, is due to abnormal genetic mutations. So you're taking the horse and the cart and reversing them. But we have clearly shown that in no uncertain terms, with massive amounts of data, that the genetic mutations are an effect. They're not the cause. And the nuclear transfer experiments are showing this. As a matter of fact now, which is an embarrassment to the field, when we do deep sequencing on various tissues in our bodies, we're finding all of these so-called cancer driver genes expressed in these tissues that never develop dysregulated cell growth. So how is it possible? And now we find cancer cells that have no mutations and they're growing out of control. And these terrible cancer driver mutations in normal tissues that never develop dysregulated growth. And then the nuclear transfer experiments are the nail in the coffin, which I've published. And you put all that together and you have to be cognitively challenged to think that cancer is a genetic disease. Yet the ideology and the industry, the system benefits financially massively from persisting with the view that cancer is a genetic disease. So again, it's
not a thing. If it's a genetic disease, the only place that we can go to get help are doctors, hospitals, and pharmaceutical companies. If, in fact, cancer is something that I can control with my lifestyle, I then am in charge and control of my health. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, that's makes perfect sense for the prevention of cancer. Right. But even if you were to use metabolic therapy as opposed to chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or radiation therapies, or these kinds of therapies, it is still important to work with a knowledgeable physician to allow you, yes, and a lot of it does fall on the back of the patient. The patient now becomes a direct participant with the oncologist in the management of their disease. They need to know what kinds of drugs to take when and how. And this is what we've developed. We developed the press pulse therapeutic strategy for managing cancer, where you can use diets and drugs together, knowing how to challenge the ability of those tumor cells to use glucose and glutamine. And there are some non-toxic drugs and some drugs that might have some level of toxicity, but if you know how to use the drug in the right scheduling timing, you can significantly reduce the amount of toxicity. So this whole concept of your hair falls out, your mucositosis, and all these different horrible side effects, we can eliminate most of those while using metabolic therapy. But it doesn't also mean that we throw out all of the tools that we have currently used for standard of care. radiation may in fact be useful in certain circumstances. Surgical debulking or removal is certainly important when done the right way. And immunotherapies, which are the hot ticket now based on the somatic mutation theory, you know, they're good for some people. Most people will not benefit or even could be harmed by those therapies. But when you use them in the right way and you shrink tumors down to small residual masses, then some of these tools that we have today could be the final way of getting rid of it. The problem is that most oncologists at the top medical centers and the pharmaceutical industry and in the National Cancer Institute, they don't know anything about this. I don't know if they don't know anything about it or they choose not to know about it. All we know is we know how to manage cancer without toxicity in a far better way than anything that's been done today. And there seems to be a tremendous amount of resistance to wanting to do this. And that's what we have to figure out.
Mentioned before that, you know, you more or less stumbled upon this through the work of Otto Warburg. And what else became confirming for you? Like, how is it that in you of so many other researchers and doctors and scientists, you know, put two and two together and realize that, you know, what we're looking at is not necessarily a genetic mutation, but there's something that is more lifestyle, nutritionally driven behind this rise in cancer?
Well, again, you know, we know that most cancers do have mutations. I mean, this is, as a matter of fact, when you see advertisements on television and all this kind of stuff, they got the ALK mutation and the EGFR mutation, we're going to target that. You know, that's great and well, but if you don't target the fuels that are causing the dysregulated growth, you're not going to kill the majority of tumors. So this is like smoke and mirror kind of thing. You're not giving the patients their full understanding of what's going on. But, you know, when I've spent many years testing Warburg's theory about the origin of cancer, we have to show that all cancers have some sort of abnormality in the number, structure, and function of the organelle that produces energy through oxygen, which is the mitochondrion. And I think that that organelle is hard to see. You can clearly see the nucleus when you look under a microscope of a cell, and the nucleus contains the genetic information. It's very easy to isolate the gene, the DNA, and sequence the DNA and see these mutations. But when you look at the mitochondria, you have to use electron microscopy, and you have to use a lot of different kinds of tools to see the abnormalities that exist in that organelle. And, you know, let me show you, let me tell you something that everybody should be completely aware of. And that is when an individual has a cardiac arrest, what we call heart attack, okay? And you know as well as I that if that heart is not stimulated or massaged or whatever, that patient is dead. But we know when a person has a heart attack, what we see is that in the bloodstream, you have a large amount of lactic acid and succinic acid buildup. These are acid molecules. Lactic acid is an end product of glucose metabolism, and succinic acid is an end product of glutamine metabolism. And we know that why would the body produce such large amounts of lactic acid and succinic acid? And the answer is because the cells are trying to stay alive using energy without oxygen, okay? So those are what we call fermentation pathways. That means energy without oxygen. So anybody that has a cardiac arrest, you will see buildup of lactic acid and succinic acid in the bloodstream because the cells are trying to stay alive using ancient fermentation pathways. But they can only do that for a short period of time because if you don't start breathing again, you're going to be dead. And the brain dies from massive lack of oxygen. All cancer cells are dumping out lactic acid and succinic acid. Why are they doing that? Because their mitochondria are inefficient in generating enough energy through oxidative phosphorylation. That's the key. You have to be cognitively challenged not to understand this. So what am I saying? I'm saying the entire cancer field is cognitively challenged because they either don't know about it or they refuse to know about it. And what are the results? 1,700 people a day dying from cancer needlessly because of their lack of ability to recognize what I'm saying, or either we really understand, but God forbid we accept what he's saying, because we're going to have to change the system. And I'm saying, why should we sacrifice all these poor cancer patients? because of a silent assumption based on ideology, which is brainwashing, essentially. It's unbelievable.
It really is.
It's a crime. It's a crime, honestly, against humanity.
It's not an intentional crime. It's a crime by negligence and lack of understanding. And you go and tell cancer patients dying in the clinics what you got there, Sloan Kettering. Oof, are you kidding me? You know, we have Dana-Farber up here, MD Anderson. You got all these Moffitts. You got all these big giant cancer institutions. And they're all just poison and irradiating people. They have no clue what I'm talking about. And if they do, they just ignore it. So, and I say, eventually it's going to change. But why do we have to sacrifice all these people? I would say it's the single greatest tragedy in the history of medicine. No question about it.
I wouldn't disagree. And when you talk, though, about metabolic therapy, so for the audience member who's not familiar with it, I mean, what does that actually mean to the patient?
What we do is oftentimes the patients, and I'm not a physician, so I don't treat anybody, but we certainly work with people who know what to do and are licensed to treat people. We need to know what their blood work looks like right off the bat. I mean, you have a lot of cancer patients, many, many, not all, that already have blood work that's way out of whack. I mean, you can see these are not, they're triglycerides and high HDL and their inflammatory C-reactive proteins, ferritin markers, vitamin D, all these things are out of whack. Sometimes they have parasitic infections they didn't even know about, fungal infections. You have to look at the blood work very, very comprehensively. Once you identify that, then you can move this patient back into a more stable state with a variety of treatments. We use zero carb diets, and then you can start to see we bring down blood sugars by using zero carb diets or water only fasting. But we bring patients, my colleagues bring the patients through the system. Okay, so once you can lower the blood sugars and raise the ketone, don't forget cancer cells cannot burn fatty acids or ketone bodies. So those are for our normal healthy cells. Our normal healthy cells can burn ketone bodies and fatty acid. Tumor cells can't. Why? Because they're mitochondria defective. Now, I can go into a deep dive on that, but I think I'd lose most listeners because there's some heavy biochemistry that supports what I'm saying. But in any event, we marginalize their ability to get energy, the tumor cells. And then once they're in this marginalized state, then we can use very nice drugs like fenbendazole, imbendazole. These are parasite medications, not because the tumor is a parasite, only because the tumor cells and the parasites use fermentation energy to stay alive. So we can kill them by using a common drug. You just have to know the biology and biochemistry of this. It appears that the majority of people in the oncology centers never heard of this. They never heard of Otto Warburg, many of them. They never knew that glucose drives dysregulated cell growth. So when you're up against a system where I just explain things, they have no clue. And it's not because they're stupid. It's because they've never been trained to know that. So the training process, they've never been educated to know that cancer cells are driven on a fermentation metabolism. So when you're taught only one thing, then that's the way you treat. And you don't think outside the box. The only thing you do know is that many of your patients are brutalized and will die as the result of this treatment. And there's no hiding those facts because we got 1,700 people a day dying. And the evidence for this comes from the American Cancer Society. They catalog the dead every year and they publish these big papers on how many people are dying. And we don't see any improvement in any of this. So, and it's not going to improve until what I'm saying becomes recognized by the system.
Hey, we hope you're enjoying our show and finding it valuable. If you could do us a quick favor, it would mean the world to us. Please take a moment to rate and review our podcast on your favorite platform. Your reviews help us reach more people and share our message. Plus, we'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for being awesome and supporting us. Now, back to the show.
You did a lot of research early on in your career around epilepsy, correct? Was that research also tied to why, to you, this made so much sense? Or at least from the nutritional standpoint, going this route of putting people on water-only fasts and or extremely low or no carbohydrate diets is an effective intervention?
Yes, absolutely. I was the head of the ketogenic diet epilepsy program, special interest groups for the American Epilepsy Society for many years. And it was very interesting. when we did this way back in the 90s, you know, we would have six or eight people at these ketogenic diet meetings. And because the pharmaceutical company, which mostly controlled the epilepsy field, you know, was not interested in this. And then Jim Abrams, the movie, and the person who makes some of those movies, you know, trying to think of them now. Anyway, there were kind of funny movies.
Airplane. I think Airplane was one of them.
Airplane. Yes. Airplane for sure. And I think maybe some Naked Gun things.
Yes.
He was a character, still is. And his son, Charlie, had epileptic seizures that were unmanaged. And he found that there was a small group at Johns Hopkins Medical School, the late John Freeman, a friend of mine, and Millicent, they were doing ketogenic. They were one of the few in the country. And Charlie was being, again, brutalized by the system, taking all kinds of drugs and procedures, wasn't working. And Jim recognized that he wanted to go and talk to Freeman and Millicent, and they found a way to manage Charlie's seizures. And Jim set up the Charlie Foundation, which then brought tremendous attention to using ketogenic diets for managing epilepsy. Of course, I had all kinds of models for epileptic seizures that we were trying to map genes and look at genetic ways to manage epilepsy. And then when we put our metabolic, our epileptic models on these ketogenic diets and calorie restriction and water only, this kind of stuff, the seizures were managed just as effectively in the mouse models that they were in children. And then we began to see the commonality of, you know, what's the mechanism by which seizures were managed. And it always had to do with a lowering glucose and elevating ketones. The mechanism was never really, and still is, under incredible investigation as to how this manages epileptic seizures over a broad range of different kinds of seizures. You know, some genetic seizures, some acquired idiopathic seizure, all these different kinds of epilepsies. But ketogenic diet metabolic therapy was very effective in managing children with all these various seizures. We also had at the same time a very parallel program in cancer biochemistry. The two paths were parallel. They were not overlapping. But then when we studied a drug that supposedly was going to be blocking some biochemical process, and we realized that it worked really well, but it was due to an indirect calorie restriction. We realized that calorie restriction was very effective in reducing cancer. And then we went back and found Otto Warburg's work, and we found that actually we supported what Otto Warburg said. And therefore, the epilepsy program, and I realized right away that the power of metabolic therapy could be massively effective against cancer, even is more effective than against epilepsy, because we actually understand the mechanism by which it worked. We still don't know the mechanism by which calorie-restricted ketogenic diets can block epileptic seizures in children. But I know very clearly how it does stops dysregulated cell growth in cancer. So once you realize that you understand how cancer forms and how cancer can be managed, and you have massive evidence to support this, then you should allow the world to know this is the strategy that will eventually become the standard of care. The problem is now is the massive resistance that the field has thrown up. And it's not the cancer patients. It's the system itself. It's a disruptive technology, and we'll have to require a reevaluation of what we're doing and how we're doing this for the majority of cancer patients. So yes, epilepsy was what brought us into an understanding of Otto Warburg's work, and we have now gone through and actually done much greater. We actually found where Otto Warburg made some mistakes and did not correctly interpret his data like we now know how it could have been. But I would say that he was the first person that really understood the nature of the problem. We have just polished it all up, brought it to a new level, and it should now become the standard of care for cancer.
Big picture for those, again, in the audience who are listening, who are wondering, you know, what should I be doing? They hear things like ketogenic diet, water-only fasts. How should they be viewing their lifestyle, or at least their nutrition, in order to help prevent, or, you know, in some cases, to treat cancer that they have?
Yeah, well, we always have to separate the prevention from the treatment, even though they might overlap. Because as I've said in my book, it's very hard to get cancer if you keep your mitochondria healthy. And I think exercise and the right diet and this kind of thing makes it much less probable that you will have a dysregulated growth somewhere in your tissues. As you said, you know, the obesity epidemic, lack of exercise, exposure to chemicals, all these kinds of things contribute to dysregulated cell growth, damage to mitochondria, and this kind of thing. So I think we have always have to separate the two. You can prevent cancer by keeping your mitochondria healthy through diet and exercise and this kind of thing. But again, I think if we look at the obesity epidemic and the chronic diseases that are really affecting so many people, there's a lack of awareness, I think. If people were really concerned about preventing cancer, we would not expect to have an obesity epidemic. The problem is the reason why we reduce smoking is because smoking was impacting the health of people near the smoker. And also it became a societal pressure. It's an interesting thing. It's the way the human brain works about things. People smoked all during the Second World War. I mean, we were smoking. Smoking was very common in restaurants. It was very common everywhere. Before you even, I grew up in the 1950s. Everybody was smoking. The 60s, in colleges, the professors were smoking. Everybody was smoking. Yes, and everybody knew was a risk factor for heart disease and cancer, but they did it anyway because it was soothing. It was a stress reliever or whatever. And they would continue to smoke had it not been for the social pressure that your secondhand smoke is influencing my health, and therefore I'm going to sue you for getting cancer and blah, blah, and all this kind of stuff. So it became a peer pressure not to smoke. And it's interesting when the American Cancer Society says that we've reduced cancer risk by 33%, making them look good. The reason is because we stopped smoking. So, and they use this projection that if we didn't stop smoking, we would have 33% more cancer deaths today than we would have. So you see how they play, the smoke? But there's no advance. Once you have metastatic cancer, there's been zero advance and it's getting worse. So with respect to diet and lifestyle and obesity, this is like, we can't put, this guy's obesity is not directly affecting your health like secondhand smoke would have. So there's no peer pressure to reduce obesity other than the fact that doing that is going to put you at risk for cancer and cardiovascular disease and all these other things. But you have to say, what is driving the obesity epidemic? And it's massive amounts of highly processed carbohydrate foods and lack of exercise. So these two are driving the environment for chronic diseases, cancer being one of them. So, but we're not harming each other. And besides, comfort foods are really enjoyed by a lot of people, myself included. I like, whenever I get a chance to eat a McDonald's hamburger, which may be once every 2 years, I enjoy it. I enjoy pizza. I enjoy a chalupa. But, you know, I'm not pounding these things every day. I mean, they're very rare treats. But I think that too many members of our society have become complacent. Okay, so where we all pay the price is in healthcare. So the healthcare bills are going up and up and up to manage a whole range of chronic disorders as the result of diet and lifestyle issues. So it's not like smoking harming you because of secondhand smoke. We're all being harmed indirectly by having to pay massive amounts of money in healthcare. And it's spread throughout the whole society. So, which all can be mostly prevented. It's really unbelievable. But the monies that are made also drive the economy. So you also have to realize that we have trade-offs. Anyway, I think the best thing to do is just be knowledgeable and let every individual make their own choice. And I'm not a big fan of having the government tell us that we can no longer eat a chalupa or eat a McDonald's hamburger because it's going to make us fat and we're going to have to pay more money to handle the problem. No. Not interested in that. We have enough problems already. But at least the people should know about it, make their own individual choices about this.
Well, it's interesting that Hippocratic Oath, right, do no harm is obviously what doctors and physicians take. But coming from a public school teaching background, I can't tell you how frustrated I wish there were more peer pressure for parents that were actually doing harm to their children by feeding them nonsense, you know, laziness, not having them move. And I'm sure I'm going to get some flack for this on this episode.
But I think there's an issue here, and it's mostly for those folks that are living paycheck to paycheck. Yeah. When you look at the price of the foods that are processed, they're the cheapest foods and they taste the best. And so it's almost like these poor folks are trapped. they're trapped in a system where they can't afford the right kinds of foods. And a lot of them know this. It's just that, man, what am I going to do? I'm a single mom. I've got three kids. I got to throw on a hamburger helper or something. I can't afford the kinds of foods that would require preparation in the evening or some more natural thing. So it's kind of, yeah, the rich people can do whatever the hell they want. But the poor folks, they're the ones that seem to be mostly hammered by this. And I feel bad for them. And I don't know what the solution other than education, but I also know they're trapped into these systems that make it hard to get out of. And then they end up with chronic disease. And then I had a student do a big paper. We have financial toxicity, which is another immoral act of the system, where a person who doesn't have much means, you know, gets a diagnosis of breast cancer, colon cancer, or whatever, and we have insurance that'll cover, maybe no insurance, and they have an out-of-pocket expense of $20,000 or $30,000, which crushes their economy, and it leads to marriage dissolutions, suicide debts, and the patient dies, and the bills are passed on to the loved one, the kids. I mean, this is tragedy. Yeah. This is what it's called financial toxicity. So not only does your hair fall out, you bleed from all orifices, your whole financial system in the household collapses. I mean, this is immoral, absolutely immoral. This shouldn't have to happen in our country today. And so you have to be very careful about how we look at all the parts on this whole thing. You know?
No, I agree. And I partially agree on the financial part. I think it's a piece of re-education. Listen, you know, if I'm to sit down and eat an egg, that egg costs me between 30 and 50 cents, which is cheaper than my bag of Oreos or whatever it might be. Would you say it's more about re-education then? Because eggs, a bunch of bananas, and honestly, ground beef, in my opinion, are cheaper than a lot of the goldfish and snacks and things that we're feeding. Or is it more that we need to systemically change, which probably, I guess, is both?
You're right. It's both. It's the educational process and a lot of these things. And also there's this, you know, resistance on the part of this corporations to say, yes, eating Fruit Loops is healthier than eating an egg. Well, what kind of a jackass would say something like that? You know, I mean, that guy ought to be reexamined. But, you know, they're interested in their bottom line. And, you know, you're going to fight for that bottom line. I mean, this is the whole thing, right? So everybody has their own perspective, but let's think of where we kind of deviate too dramatically from this. Yes, of course, the egg and ground beef. In fact, that's an unbelievable way to get super healthy. It's called steak and eggs, actually.
lunch and dinner today.
We pretty much live by that. But it's just interesting too, because you do talk about, like, this is a systemic issue, and, you know, government will not hesitate to subsidize junk food,
corn,
but also just via welfare. Right? Somebody shows up with a WIC check at a grocery store, and they can pile their cart full of Lay's potato chips and all these other things. And yet the things that are healthiest for them, as you pointed out, are the most expensive.
That I think goes to your educational mission, and also for the health and welfare of your children. And, you know, when you see little obese kids, you say, oh, this is really a tragic situation. And because their lifespan is going to be significantly reduced as the result of this health crisis. But, you know, my goal is not so much those societal issues and trying to convince our population what we should or should not do. It's right now we have all these poor cancer patients dying in these clinics being brutalized. And I think that we can put a drop in that significantly. And I think you work from there. I think you work from the effect of what you're able to do in this sphere, and then have it translate over to other spheres, so that we don't have to put ourselves in that position in the first place. So I think but these are moving parts in a very difficult situation. So, but I think we got to start and make progress where we can and how we can do that. And that's where I'm focused right now.
It's hard to be swimming upstream, so to speak, in a society where everyone's swimming the opposite direction. And I think for Otto, he was early. He was just early in human history with some of his research and ideas. And unfortunately, they were cast aside.
He was a very arrogant, dominated character, and he did not suffer fools in any way. And I think he was very discouraged at the end of his life when he saw the whole field abandoning his concepts. But also one of the things that he did or didn't do that we did he knew nothing about ketogenic metabolic therapy. So, and I felt that his deviation, he said we could reduce cancer deaths by 80% by keeping the mitochondria healthy, which I agree with. But his attempts to try to rejuvenate these abnormal mitochondria with certain enzymes was his plan, which I found a little unusual because he said once the mitochondria become damaged, the damage is irreversible. So putting in enzymes in his strategy didn't seem to be the right way to go about it. The way we're going about it is actually embodying what he really should have. But at that time, he didn't know about amino acid fermentation, and he didn't know about ketogenic metabolic therapy. So the two strategies that we use was not known to him, but he was the guy. So you have to build upon the shoulders of those that he established the basis, the platform, and now we build up from that in the correct direction, which I think will be eventually recognized as the way to do all this.
Just to get a little technical for a moment, you know, I think it's pretty clear and evident to many people that there is that the glucose component to cancer. The glutamine one is definitely one that I have heard less about. Most people will immediately point to glucose. In fact, I mean, how do you light up cancer cells, right? On a test, you use glucose. But the glutamine is very interesting to me because glutamine being an amino acid coming from our protein sources, how does this line up with respect to nutritional recommendations, or does it?
Yeah, well, it's a very important point where we're studying that right now. And in the scientific field of cancer metabolism, the glutamine issue is well recognized. I mean, almost everybody working in cancer biochemistry knows that there is a big role for glutamine here. The controversy that we have right now in the cancer field is whether glutamine is respired or fermented. And the majority of cancer people think it's respired, meaning that Otto Warburg was incorrect. Our big breakthrough in this field was showing, no, it's not respired, it's fermented. Just like I said, when you see the succinic acid coming out, that's a marker for glutamine fermentation, not respiration. So this is right now a big issue in the cancer field. But getting back to the nutritional issues of glutamine, yes, we know it. It's hard to say. Glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in our body. We have to be very, very careful on how we target glutamine because we can impair our immune system. Our immune system uses tremendous amounts of glutamine in the process of fighting bacteria and in healing disease. The health of our gut, our microbiome, is heavily dependent on glutamine. Our urea cycle needs the glutamine. So, and this is where when I said press pulse strategy for managing cancer, we have to really know how to the dosage, timing, and scheduling of glutamine management so not to harm the rest of the body. But if a cancer patient were to consume large amounts of glutamine, the issue is, could it potentially accelerate the growth of the tumor, especially in combination with a high carbohydrate diet? And the answer is, we're working on that right now. We're trying to figure this out. We do know that the simultaneous targeting of glucose and glutamine will have a major impact on stopping the dysregulated growth for sure. We're not really yet sure what role nutritional consumption of glutamine would antagonize our attempt or enhance our attempt. We don't know. So I'm not saying we have all of the knowledge done right now. And this is where the cutting edge is right now. In fact, it's specifically addressing what you just said. How is the best way to keep a good, healthy diet that might require meats and things like this, while at the same time depriving the tumor cell of the fermentation of the glutamine? So right now, this is where we are. And our research is supported by private foundations and philanthropy. And we will figure this out. There's no question about it. This is a problem that has a solution. But we would like to inform cancer patients for their benefit to know when and how we can maintain a healthy diet and lifestyle while at the same time depriving the tumor cells of the very fuel that's needed for their dysregulated growth. So this is where we are right now. So, you know, and what I'm saying, we're trying to train oncologists and physicians to know this. We have a huge treatment protocol that we have under review now for publication that brings all this to the awareness. It's a how-to protocol for the treatment of glioblastoma, which is a deadly brain cancer. But the same treatment protocol will be used eventually for the management of all cancers. And we're collecting information to address the very question that you asked to give us the best the best overall answer to this. And that's where we are right now.
Exciting. I know you want to get technical. I want to just take this back to first grade for a quick moment. And that is, so looking at chronic dysregulation of our mitochondria, we know from fifth grade biology that our mitochondria is the energy center of a cell. And the two fuel sources you covered here that would feed that would be glucose and glutamine. Can you just first grade level for our listeners, how are we damaging our mitochondria? I know you already said this, but I really want it to be driven home for people. How are we damaging our mitochondria? And how do we keep our mitochondria healthy?
Well, the healthy is just diet and lifestyle, you know, keeping your glucose. That's why we developed the glucose ketone index calculator, which is like health guys like you folks. I built it for the cancer patients, but I know a lot of health gurus and exercise people are using the GKI, which is the how low you're keeping the balance. Because I'm talking about this first before I talk about how we damaged the mitochondria in the first place. You have to realize all of our Paleolithic ancestors were always in a state of nutritional ketosis. And how did we know that? Because their diet and lifestyles were very dynamic. They were moving. They didn't have automobiles, and we didn't have delicatessens on every corner. So they're tracking down animals and killing them and eating them and cooking them. These are not highly carbohydrate foods. You would get carbs primarily from seasonal activities. You know, when fruits are ripe or berries are ripe, you'd get some carbohydrates that way. So we were always in a state of nutritional ketosis. And well, how would we know cancer was rare? Because we know that Aboriginal tribes on the planet today that live according to their ancestral ways rarely have cancer. So cancer is very rare in people who live according to their ancestral diets and lifestyles. So we know that. It's a fact. So how we deviated so far from those through our technology, making things easier and easier and easier. So living in a state of nutritional ketosis, which is Paleolithic, basically, and our technology says it's much easier to eat jelly-filled donuts and pizzas than it is to, you know, track down a deer during deer season and actually, you know, not using a gun, but using a trap or a bow and arrow or a knife or some damn thing. And I mean, there's a lot of energy going into chopping up a deer and eating it, right? It's not easy. You think about it. And then
processing an animal is no joke.
I mean, this was our existence for hundreds of thousands of years doing this kind of stuff. And only within the last, you know, couple of generations, we went from these lean, tough, well-physiqued men and women into this morbidly obese, population. And so how are we damaging our mitochondria? And I went through all this because this was considered the oncogenic paradox launched by the Nobel laureate, Albert Szent-Györgyi. He said, how do you get cancer? Where's all this? It was called, and we solved that. I solved the oncogenic paradox by showing carcinogens in the environment damage oxidative phosphorylation, causing mitochondrial oxphos to become chronically reduced and leading to a compensatory fermentation. Intermittent hypoxia, which can happen from sleep apnea. Being obese with sleep apnea can damage mitochondria. So radiation, everybody knows, you know, it's amazing. You know, when the Fukushima plant in Japan went off because of the earthquake, people were digging bunkers in Seattle because they feared the radiation cloud coming over from Japan. Why? Well, I didn't want to get cancer from, yet you have cancer, they bring you in, they nuke you. I mean, the whole thing doesn't make any sense. So radiation can damage oxidative phosphorylation, leading to compensatory fermentation. And we also have the chronic inflammation. Many, many people who are obese have high C-reactive protein. C-reactive protein in the blood is a marker for systemic inflammation. Systemic inflammation damages mitochondrial function, leading to compensatory fermentation and dysregulated cell growth. Then we have the germline inherited mutations like BRCA1, P53. And people always say to me, oh, cancer has to be genetic because we, you know, Angelina Jolie goes out and gets her ovaries and breasts removed or something like this. She fears the gene that's going to give her breast cancer. Those are risk factors, secondary. They're not primary risk factors, mainly because there are many women that have the BRCA1 mutation that never develop breast cancer. So what's going on with that? And everybody that does have the BRCA1 and does get a breast tumor or an ovarian tumor or whatever, they all have defective mitochondria and they're fermenting. So clearly, the gene causes damage to the mitochondria function, leading to compensatory fermentation. Why some people with the gene never develop cancer is another issue. It's different. And the answer is we don't yet know about that. So, and then what about viruses? Oh yeah, we have oncogenic viruses. That's why people get these vaccines for papilloma, because papillomaviruses damage oxidative phosphorylation in the mitochondria, leading to compensatory fermentation. Same with hepatitis. Hepatitis C is a big condition for liver cancer. And I have shown, and others with evaluated the literature, and we showed that hepatitis C enters the mitochondria, causing chronic interruption of oxphos, leading to compensatory fermentation and dysregulated cell growth. So I went through, and age, the older you get, the more likely you're going to get cancer, because your mitochondria become damaged from diet and lifestyle issues over a longer period of time, leading to compensatory fermentation and dysregulated cell growth. I mean, you can go right down the list over and over and over again. The thing that's
like a theme
bothering me, or alerting all of us, is that younger people, I'm getting so many emails from young folks in their 30s and 40s with all kinds of cancers, breast cancer, colon cancer, you know, bladder cancer. What the hell is going on? And again, it's our diet and lifestyle that's making us have cancer at earlier ages. So clearly, this is a chronic problem of diet and lifestyle. And you put that together with contaminants in the environment, and then you have this problem. The problem is, in my mind, is clearly known. We know what's causing it, and we know how to treat it. The society needs to be educated to know this.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that.
Talking specifically about prevention, how important of a role does autophagy play? I mean, should people who have no signs of cancer or any other metabolic diseases right now be concerned or be mindful of putting themselves in a state where autophagy is triggered, or is this of no concern whatsoever if we're just generally living a healthy lifestyle?
No, I think it's part of that. That's, in fact, you should know that autophagy is the replacement of dysfunctional organelles within the cell. Like a mitochondrion that's not producing enough energy efficiently can be brought to the lysosome, which is the internal digestive system of the cell. And the mitochondria are broken down through the autophagy process. And the fuels of the mitochondria are then redistributed to the cell. So the cell becomes, and new mitochondria are created to make themselves more healthy. The best way to increase autophagy is water-only fasting. And nobody wants to do that. Okay. So we know how to do it. And this is a term that I produced in my book called autolytic cannibalism, which is essentially an autophagic condition at a higher level. When there's a level of sugar, blood sugar, or energy in our bloodstream, the body becomes a little bit more tolerant of inefficiency, because most of the cells are getting as much energy as they can, and therefore they're not the autophagic surveillance system is lax. And we allow then cells to become energetically inefficient and potentially leading to a chronic problem with mitochondrial function. And the body is tolerating that because all the cells are fat and happy. When you start to restrict calories and the body now recognizes that there is a gradual reduction in external energy, then there's surveillance systems that kick in, which are evolutionarily conserved. Now every cell in the body has to account for its efficiency. Otherwise, it will be eliminated and used as fuel for the rest of the body. So this is autophagy at a higher level, and I call it autolytic cannibalism. And this is where, if the cell is there and it's inefficient, we have an immune system that will come in, eat that inefficient cell, and then distribute the fuels to the rest of the body. And so you have an internal autophagy system, making sure that the mitochondria within the cells are humming at their maximum energy efficiency, which is burning ketone bodies, by the way. And where you're getting the ketone bodies, because you're not getting fuel, so your body starts mobilizing fats. Fats go to the liver, ketone bodies come out, and they can replace glucose as an energy source. And they also reduce reactive oxygen species. So you really get pristine energy efficiency when you're burning ketones. But you don't burn ketones until you go below that general threshold of energy. And as far as if you have an incipient growth that's there, the body will turn on it, and it's called autolytic cannibalism, where the body itself will recognize that this population of dysregulated cells is not contributing to good of the whole, we attack it and dissolve it, and then we redistribute the fuels to the rest of the body. So this is the way we become super. And this is all evolutionary concern. What I'm talking about is all evolutionary biology. So in order to understand what I'm saying, you have to understand how we evolved as a species on the planet, where energy came from in the first place, and how all these organisms evolved. They're all highly energy efficient if under the right conditions. This is how we came about. We didn't come about in a society where we have massive amounts of readily available poor energy leading to all the chronic problems that we have. So yeah, when you understand the systems, everything makes perfect sense. But the temptation of those systems to remain in an unhealthy state is so overpowering. You know, we've tweaked the foods and we've tweaked the conveniences. Let's be honest. As I said to people, you don't even have to expend energy getting out of your car to buy a hamburger. It's handed through a window to you. I mean, this is all contributed to energy inefficiency.
It can be delivered to you. You can just call Uber Eats and have it delivered. I mean, right. You don't have to get the car.
I know. It's even that less energetic. And I know it can really, it's killing us as a society. And that's one of our contributions to the world. I call it the great American diet and lifestyle.
I'll never forget going to Italy. And I was like, I'm hungry at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And they were like, sorry, everything's closed. And I'm like, what do you mean everything's closed? I mean, it's so crazy that literally at 2 o'clock in the morning, I could decide I want a Big Mac and fries and it's delivered to my door by someone.
Oh, yeah. Well, people like this. This is like convenience. This is the consequences of our incredible technology. But there's always a downside. There's a good side and a downside. There's a dark side to this, and we're paying the price of it.
With autophagy, you know, how I generally explain it, I'm a former elementary school teacher. So I like to break things into first grade so everybody can conceptualize. Autophagy is kind of like Pac-Man, where the inefficient cells get eaten up by the good, strong cells. Would you say that that's accurate?
That's autolytic cannibalism. Autophagy is internal to the cell. So mitochondria internal to the cell would be digested in the lysosome. That's autophagy. Autophagy is within the cell. It's a reconfiguration within the cell. Whereas autolytic cannibalism is what you just said, is where the body will attack the weak cells and dissolve. So it's a different level of a similar strategy.
Makes sense. Thank you for that clarification. And then secondly, when we think about this overconsumption of glucose and having too much energy, it's almost like an inefficient company where there's a boss that doesn't care and workers that don't care. And so we become very inefficient. That surveillance system is decreased. Whereas when we have someone like Mike come in to restructure and work and get everyone disciplined, that's the equivalent of us removing this excess glucose from our bodies and our bloodstreams, so that we can become more effective, not obese, and maybe less susceptible to chronic inflammation, which would lead to cancer. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. You know, the issue is exercise. And like we were in the past, having to do a lot of exercise. Now, we're not tracking down and killing mastodons and this kind of thing. But there are other ways to achieve a level of exercise that keeps our... Don't forget, the more... energy, oxygen you bring into your body, and the more you use your muscles and things, the more healthy your mitochondria become. And it's also a way to reduce glutamine as well. Glutamine goes down with heavy exercise. So that's George Cahill, my late friend from the Joslin Diabetes Center, published some papers on that. So yes, absolutely. And the best way, I think, is if we can burn ketones, which unfortunately requires some reduction in carbohydrates. That's why you need the glucose ketone index calculator, which we published, open access. Now, the Keto Mojo meter, and you know, there's a free Libra that's coming. Our technology is advancing in the area of managing our physiology, I guess you could say. The Keto Mojo you have to prick your finger to get a drop of blood like diabetics would, but you can use a glucose strip and then a ketone strip, and then you push the button on the meter and it gives you your glucose ketone index. And that the lower the index, the healthier you become. So as for cancer, we said 2.0 and below will be the threshold upon which the body then begins to restrict the growth of the tumor cell. But for health gurus and these kinds, they can also get down into these zones. And, you know, when we do it, young people, of course, it's always easier for young than the older people. The brain becomes more addicted to glucose, harder to get. When you get older, your body doesn't transition as readily as it does when you're young. So you got to know that. And, you know, young people can get into these zones really quick. So they get the meter and they're going out and they're doing tremendous exercise and they're eating low carbohydrate foods and they're looking at their GKI. Whoa, look at this. It's really low. How do you feel? I feel great, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So, but, you know, you take people that are not that way and you look at your GKI and you go, oh my God, this is, you know, it should be lower, but at least it's a quantitative measure to give people an opportunity to see where they stand in the level of their exercise and health. That's why this is really an important tool, not only for those that have cancer or other chronic diseases, but also for those that want to stay healthy and prevent those things from happening in the first place. So there's a quantitative measure you can use. And of course, as I said, the free Libra is something you can attach to your arm or your leg or wherever, and it will give you a real-time reading of your blood sugar. But you have to have the real-time reading of your ketones as well, because it's the ratio of the two that really puts you into this new therapeutic state. And as glucose goes down and ketones go up, your mitochondria get super healthy, you reduce reactive oxygen species, you increase the delta G prime of ATP hydrolysis, which is really a bioenergetic concept that's really interesting. But the issue here is that there is a science behind everything that I'm telling you. Yeah. But it's also, you have to recognize that it's a personal way of knowing this information and applying it to your personal condition.
Well, it's interesting too, because, you know, as you brought up many times, this was not an issue at a time when we didn't have all of these conveniences, we didn't have technology. And now here we are, in effect, trying to turn back time in the sense that we have to make these decisions consciously to exercise in a way that is, you know, going to be intense and help us to deplete glycogen from our body, from our muscles and our liver, and then also eat in a fashion that basically goes against what is promoted in the mainstream. And so there is like a certain level of heightened consciousness that we need to take with respect to all of these lifestyle choices.
Well, I have one more question. I've been thinking about this as we're here, this fermentation that happens within our cells. So fermentation within our cells is not good, yet there's benefits to
it. Wait. All of our erythrocytes, blood cells, are doing fermentation. They have no mitochondria nucleus. So they're always producing a residual level of lactic acid. So our blood cells are fermenters. That's why they have a finite lifespan. So they're turned over in our liver. So you're right. With the exception of red blood cells, they'll always put that with the exception of our red blood cells, fermentation metabolism only happens when we have a deprivation of oxygen. Like if you use your muscles really, really vigorously, you'll build up lactic acid in the bloodstream and succinic acid because your muscles are working faster than oxygen can generate energy. So we use fermentation energy, and that energy comes from the glycogen stored in our muscles. Our muscles, glycogen is just a large amount of glucose molecules linked together. The interesting thing is our muscles do not share their sugar with anyone like the brain or other organs, because that's an evolutionary conserved thing. Because if you were being chased by a lion or a tiger and your muscles were giving the energy to your brain so you can contemplate what's going on, the tiger is going to get you and kill you. All right. So you need to run from the tiger. I mean, this is all, it took millions of years for this stuff to happen. It didn't happen overnight.
That's amazing.
So why the muscle doesn't share the sugar that the brain loves, right? So, but you're right. The liver has a lot of glycogen that will be used for the brain. So yes, we're a machine. We're an unbelievably sophisticated biological machine that was built over millions of years of evolution to survive an environment. Our technology, which came as the result of other things, is appreciated, but can also put us at risk for some of these things. So you're right. But I think your mission is to educate is probably the most important mission that we can have at this time.
Thank you. And definitely it is. What about fermented foods? You know, kimchi, pickles?
No, that's different. That's how to produce the food. Beer is a fermented alcohol.
Well, so what's interesting is someone's going to listen to this and say, hold on, is fermentation good or is fermentation bad?
No, and they will. They absolutely will, because I've seen it in the comments. What about sauerkraut? Can I eat sauerkraut? No. Fermentation is made to sauerkraut. And beer. And
I know how people think, Mike. I know what they're going to think.
And they all tell me I can tell you the crazy things. They think cancer is a parasite. Wrong. It's not. No, you can eat fermented foods, you know. And again, it all comes back to general knowledge of biochemistry and evolutionary biology. And unfortunately, we have a massive lack of information. And as Carl Sagan said, you know, the field runs on science and technology, and almost no one knows anything about science and technology, much less how our bodies work.
Very true. Thank you for addressing that. So sourdough bread, kimchi, like keep eating your fermented foods. It's just that fermentation in our body.
If you want to keep your GKI low, I mean, you can find, everybody can know what they can and cannot eat. And they always ask me, what can I eat? I don't know. Measure your GKI and it'll tell you right away what you can and cannot eat. Not complicated. Yeah.
That, I mean, and I love that too, because, you know, that always has always, that's always been a big part of the argument, is that so many people, just because of genetic inclinations, can get away with eating certain foods, so to speak. Like it doesn't have the same effect as that same food may have on someone else.
You're absolutely right. Each person is a unique individual. And I see a lot of comments. They say, oh, he never said what I should eat. And I'm not going to tell you what to eat. Your GKI will tell you what to eat. All right. That's just that simple. Go out and measure GKI and it will tell you what you can and cannot eat. I'm not going to tell you that.
We can tell you stop eating Chips Ahoy, Oreos, and Lay's potato chips. That we can say.
Well,
in excess.
Let that you'll get the eye opener when you see that.
Yeah, it's true.
Or drink a Coca-Cola. Unbelievable, man. You know those things you see at the carnival where you take the mallet and you hit this thing and the thing goes up and rings the bell. You know, you have to hit it hard. Most people can't. You can see when you drink a Coca-Cola, you ring that bell.
I'm sure.
Of unhealth.
It really is. Well, listen, Dr. Seafried, this has been like a fascinating conversation. We just so appreciate you coming on with us and talking with us, our audience. You know, we in our line of work, we do come across a lot of clients, especially who have either gone through cancer, are currently going through cancer. And so I know this information is going to be like truly valuable to them. And we do believe that this is probably the most important conversation that anyone's going to hear on this podcast, because as you said, you have 1,700 people a day dying as a result of this disease, and that so much of this is preventable, along with many other diseases that we see, such as cardiovascular disease and diabetes, you know, hypertension, Alzheimer's. Like a lot of this stuff is preventable just by through lifestyle. So I just wanted to say that, you know, we truly appreciate your work and thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you. And you guys also have to realize you're part of the solution in this change. So your information and the people that you work with and come to you and you relay this information and education, you're actually participating in the eventual change. So you have a very important role in this whole mission to bring us to a better state of health or reduce chronic diseases, either way. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. Just finally, your book, which we will link to in the comments.
Yeah. My book now is selling more than it did when I published it in 2012. It's unbelievable. In fact, I'm even shocked. Apparently, they're finally coming to realize what's going on. And we've made a lot more advances since the book, but the book pretty much lays it all out. But yeah, it's apparently, and it's not cheap. You know, people always get angry with me and say, oh, you're making so much money on this book. John Wiley, the big publisher, John Wiley Press set the price for that book, not me. I wanted it to be, you know, $5. Oh no, they wanted to make $150. You know, so they made $1 million on the book that I wrote. And I don't even come close to making that kind of money.
You know that well.
Yeah, Jesse.
Mike makes about 20 cents on royalties from his. Yeah. So we know it.
Yeah. It's true. It's like if you're looking to get rich,
publishers make the big money.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're also going to link to you know, all the places that people can find you in our show notes. But again, once again, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It was nice being here.
Thanks for tuning in. If you're a busy working parent like us, you understand the daily challenges. Our mission is to make exercise and nutrition simple and exciting, helping you and your family thrive even on the busiest days. We've got a fantastic free 5-day online challenge that's tailor-made for super busy people like you.
If you like a high-vibe workout environment with professional coaching, swing by one of our franchise studios for a free intro workout.
Check the show notes for details or head on over to purephysique.com when you have a moment. We know those moments are rare.
Until next time, lift weights, eat meat, and never forget, you were created on purpose for a purpose.
Surely there must be something you can do.
I'm doing everything I can. And stop calling me Shirley.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.
Now I'm not.
No.